Hey, family. Welcome back to the Mars Invasion. Firstly, I have to say I'm floored by the feedback that I've been receiving so far. Also, special shout out to my listeners in France. I see you. On this episode, I got a chance to interview my friend, Derek Sire. Derek is a leadership coach, has a master's in divinity, and is an author. Derek impresses me in that he is a man of high influence while being one of the most approachable, hilarious, and genuine people I've ever met. Check this out. Who is Derek Sire?
Oh, who is Derek Sire? Derek Sire is a hugger. Aww. Derek Sire is someone who loves to laugh. Derek Sire is someone who appreciates a good cry. Derek Sire is someone who longs for genuine friendship. Derek Sire is someone who loves his children. Derek Sire is someone who loves his dad. Derek Sire is a mentor. And Derek Sire is somebody who cares what other people think, probably to a fault. Derek Sire is someone who wears his heart on his sleeve. And Derek Sire is emotional, and he's passionate. And I don't know, I think that's it. Derek Sire is somebody that can appreciate a good play and a movie. I come up with 10 ideas a day, and probably will do one of them in a lifetime. So I'm a dreamer.
That's dope.
Derek Sire is someone who hopes all things, who believes all things, who loves all things. Derek Sire is someone who loves the way music makes his soul vibrate. Derek loves to dance. Derek Sire is someone who strives to be a good husband and fails often. Derek Sire is somebody that enjoys to be barefoot but hates things touching his feet.
Yes, I get that. I resonate. I get it, bro.
Yeah, yeah. Derek Sire loves early mornings and holding hands. I love eye contact. I don't know. I'm just a feeler, man. Like, I just appreciate feeling. I had a friend that said if he had to choose one emotion or no emotion, he would choose none, because one would be the same. And he said that,
yeah,
just talking about the value of feeling all emotion. Like, if you have only just one, you have nothing to compare it to, and so it might as well be none. So the older I get, the more I appreciate crying and trying to learn from disappointment and failures. It's just, I don't know, man, I'm just a feeler, bro. Like, I just love it, man. I love people and practicing my intuition. Yeah, let's dare.
That's some powerful stuff, man. And I think you're a leader, and I'm going to say stuff you did not say, but it's really, really true. Derek Sire can sing his face off. Derek Sire is a leader. Derek Sire is a man. And I admire you, because I feel like you embody what it is to be masculine and a feeler. And I feel like a lot of us men have issues. Well, I guess that's where this interview's going. I think toxic masculinity is a thing. It's not just something that liberals or whoever says. I absolutely think that it is a thing. I think for years, and it changes over time, but I think for years, men have been taught, discouraged, and programmed to be a certain way or to be a certain frame. And that's not the case. So I want you to kind of talk about Derek Sire, the man, and how he got to a place where he was comfortable and knew who he was as someone that's masculine and someone that is a feeler, and how those are one in the same.
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think people, they make masculinity and feeling polar, right? They polarize the two. And, you know, I don't want to sound like or come off like a psychiatrist or a psychologist or somebody that studies, you know, human behavior or anything like that. But I just know the culture that I grew up in. As a man, you only got to express a few emotions. It was excitement, anger, jealousy, happiness. And I don't even know if those are core emotions. I have a friend, Hillary, said in one of her classes, and she talked about core emotions. And, you know, when you say you feel something, an emotion has to follow. And I think, you know, comes with a thought, you know, or something along those lines. So I've been trying to practice that. I think when people hear masculine or man, they only attach a few emotions to that. And I think growing up, while I saw one thing in my community, I mean, my dad was really adamant about giving me room and space to express all emotions. Instead of stop crying, it was, why are you crying?
Yeah.
You know, crying wasn't a sign of weakness. It was a reason to probe or discover. You know, like, are you pouting? Are you afraid? Are you sad? Like, why are you crying? Or why are you angry? Why are you mad? Why are you frustrated? It was more of this trying to create someone that wasn't stuck in an archaic perspective of feeling an emotion and self-awareness. Just trying to create this well-rounded man that was able to work hard and love his kids, you know, stand up with a straight back, a strong spine, let his yes say yes and his no mean no, keep his word, firm handshake, eye contact, and then it's okay to cry. You know, like, it's okay to love. It's okay to hug. My dad, until he passed, still when he saw me, kissed me on my face.
Yeah.
That's something that I will forever carry with me to this day. I try to remember to kiss my son every night before he goes to bed. If I don't come to him, he comes to me. I hug him often. But I also tell him, you know, get in there, wash some dishes, make your food, take the trash out, unload the groceries for your mama. Like, there's just some things that I want him to grow up with. And if I can build on what my dad tried to instill in me and put it in my son, then he's going to be a better man than me or my dad could ever be. And I think that's what I think of when I think of masculinity, when I think of emotion, when I think of feelings. I think of being secure and giving space and acknowledgement to those weak moments. I think everybody experiences them, but I don't know that everybody gives space to them.
Yeah.
Some of our greatest examples, you know, I'm a Bible man. I mean, I love theology. I love philosophy. And our greatest, one of the greatest men in the Bible, you know, if we had to have a top 10, then David is going to be one of them, right? This guy, he showed fear. He was a warrior. In fact, he wasn't allowed to build the temple because God said he had shed too much blood. He was loyal. He wrote Psalms. He was a musician. He played the harp to soothe Saul. He was a lover. He danced in the streets. In fact, it says he danced out of his clothes. He was a hard worker. He worked in the field. Like, this is a guy that expressed a wide range of emotions. He was flawed, and he was a man after God's own heart. Like, this is top 10, I would say, people in the Bible. If we ask them to identify a man, yet I don't know that we aspire to explore the full range of that kind of masculinity. So, I mean, if we're gonna talk Bible, let's talk Bible. You know, if we're gonna talk about well-roundedness, if we're gonna talk about the whole man, let's talk about it. Let's talk about Jesus, who laid hands, who walked on water, who flipped tables and whipped people out of the temple and held children. Let's talk about that guy, right? Let's talk about that guy who wept, Let's talk about that guy who looked another man in the face and said, yo, if you're about to betray me, go do what you came here to do. You know what I'm saying? Like, we can make Jesus street and we can make him a lamb because he was both in. And I just don't think that we look at it from that perspective.
That's powerful, man. That's powerful. Let's talk about Derek Sire, the leader. Can we talk about your books?
Yes. My first book was Small Stories, Big Teams. And it talks about just the little big experiences that people bring to life, they bring to the table, that they bring to organizations, that they bring to marriage and families. And so I go and I identify all these small stories, and I use these analogies to talk about just the small components to being a part of a bigger picture. The second book was My Life of List. And for a while, I was on social media sharing these lists. Like, I would just see things in a day, and I would list everything that I saw. And it was humorous, and part of it was fun. I talked about my marriage and my family and things like that. And I pulled those off social media, bound them, expounded on some of the concepts, and talked about why it's important to slow down. In the introduction of that book, you know, I say there are some people who stop and smell the flowers. They smell the rose. They stop. And that's good. But this book is for people who, while smelling the flower, they look in the grass and see the worms, and they see the ladybugs, and they see the type of soil, and they see all these different things. It's looking past that initial observation, trying to see what else life has for us. And I think that's the core of who I am, who I try to be. And so Derek's how the leader, man. I don't even, you know, it's crazy when I hear that word attached to my name, because I just think, you know, I'm my own worst critic. I probably beat myself up a lot. And my failures, they shine brighter than my successes. And so I'm always hesitant to throw that type of identifier with my name. But I'm just a guy, man. And this isn't false humility. It's not like,
yeah, I know.
You know, I just try to do the best that I can in every situation, knowing that, you know, eventually I'll mess up, but I'll keep going. And I think those are leaders, man. They're people who fail and they're like, okay, man, I'm gonna just keep going. Like, I found another way that didn't work. And it just adds to the story, the testimony. So Derek, the leader, works in the community. He mentors middle school and high school age kids. He's part of a youth leadership academy with the Oklahoma City Police Department. Derek, the leader, tries to, you know, partner with his wife and lead the family in the right direction. You know, Derek's the leader.
Let's rewind. When did you, I'll get to the books later. I feel like I asked that poorly. I want to rewind back to before there was a book, before there was your leadership training and your workshops. What was the first iteration of all of this? What came first?
Man, I don't know. That's like asking somebody when they started singing. You know, like, if I asked you when you started singing, it's like you got to go back to grandma's kitchen when you was three, you know, singing ABCs with a spoon as a mic. Like, it's like you're asking somebody. So when I think about before the books, you know, before the business and the company, before marriage, before kids, before degrees, before all this stuff, man, I remember just being a kid that was in middle school. Like, I helped start a gang called the Juice Crew when I was in elementary school. Yeah, and we had, like, commandeered the monkey bars, and they was ours. Like, this is our monkey bars, and if you come over here, you better come with a juice box. You know what I'm saying? Like, I remember meeting in my attic with people, and we had dues, and that was like a dollar a meeting. You know what I'm saying? Like, I remember I was a kid walking around. I'm dead serious.
What were y'all meeting about?
Bro, like, it was anything. Like, what playground equipment we was going to take over next week? I had a friend that had a bike, and his tube busted. And so we took Juice Crew money, and we bought him an inner tube. Because it was like, bro, we can't all have bikes and you walking. So the Juice Crew, we got to roll together. So, you know what I'm saying? Like, it was just weird. So it's like, I just remember a little thing. I remember me and one of my best friends, Dwayne, we was in church one day. And he was like, hey, man, you want a fake shout? And I was like, let's. was like, let's do it. And so we stood up and we started fake shouting, and that whole church lit on fire, boy.
Church like, kids, man.
I know what I'm saying. Like, we was just, I remember leading church choir, doing solos. I remember when I was 16, getting a job and being a shift manager at 17 when I was in high school. You know what I'm saying? I remember being in three choirs and five sports and French club. When I was in high school, I remember, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's just wherever I went, man, you see those gaps and those holes. So there's always somebody that's willing to step in there and either, you know, take the brunt of the load or be embarrassed. And maybe I'm a glutton for punishment. I don't know what it is. But I can't find the beginning, man. It's just a thread that has been throughout my life.
I love that. Why a book? Yeah. Going back to your first book. Why a book?
Yeah. You know, I think what happened was, I can tell you the actual part what happened, and then I'm going to tell you the conceptual part.
Absolutely.
I grew up in North Tulsa, bro. You may have played a sport and made it out. You know what I'm saying? Like, I still got people, you know, the common story is drugs, gangs, you know, the narrative is changing, especially with the school that I went to, but it was just, I wasn't supposed to be an author. I wasn't supposed to have 2 or 3 degrees. You know what I'm saying? I'm not supposed to get married and then have kids. You know what I'm saying? I'm not supposed to own homes or car. Like, that just, I just felt like that wasn't necessarily what I saw around me. And so writing a book, it was like, that wasn't even a thought. It wasn't even a thought. But what I did do well was write stories. I wrote stories. Like, I could, my dad was a storyteller. He would have you sucked all the way in, like eating out of the palm of his hands. He could do card tricks. He could sing. He could play the guitar. Like, he was just very charismatic. And so I just picked it up, just being around dad, just telling stories, like how he did it. And I used to work for a natural gas, oil and gas company here in Oklahoma City. And I went through one of their layoffs. I wanted to start this business where I got a chance to do team building and tell stories and speak and encourage people and motivate. And one of the things that I would do for the companies is that I would follow up with these little bitty stories that talked about team building. And I remember the very first ones I wrote was Humpty Dumpty. It was like, why was he on the wall? How did he fall? Who's standing around? You know what I'm saying? Who's standing around him? Like, why isn't anybody putting Humpty back together again? And that ended up being the tagline, Humpty Dumpty, and why nobody is willing to put him back together again. And I talked about broken environments and broken homes and broken churches and broken work groups and why everybody just stands around and they don't want to put the work to put their situation back together again.
Come on.
And I sent it out, and people will reply, and they'd be like, hey, man, you got another one of those? Like, I sent it to my team, and we started having our staff meeting based on their story.
That's dope.
And I was like, yeah. And so I sent another one called The Seven Doors, talking about the seven work types in environments, the seven work personalities in a work environment. I sent it out. They was like, hey, man, you got another one of those? And I was like, wait a minute, are these good? Like, people kept asking for them. And so I had a website, and I was posting them on my website, and I was talking to, at the time, my brand manager, and she was like, just pull them off the web, pull everything off the website, and let's bound them. Let's put them in a PDF, and let's see who would be interested in this. I did it, put the book together, hooked up with a graphic designer, and then by myself pushed a little over 1,200 copies, which isn't a lot. You know, it's not a number one seller. I'm sure there are people out there that are hustling. But for me, a dude from North Tulsa selling 1,200 copies of a book just on his own.
That's awesome.
Insane. And so after that, the same thing kind of organically happened with the second book. I was putting stuff online. People were loving it, talking about, you know, how it brightens their day. And so I pulled them off. I bound them, expanded on the stories a little bit. Ended up pushing over 1,000 copies on that. In fact, like when I go, I still take books with me. And so those things, both of the books are still in rotation, which is, it's stupid, man. You know, when I think about stuff like that, it's like, I don't even want to get into grace. I don't even get into mercy. I don't even want to get into favor and ram. And I don't even want to get into that stuff, man, because that's like my whole life it's just, anyhow.
In the process of becoming an author, what was the hardest thing you've had to either learn and or endure?
Feeling unworthy. Mm. That's something that I battle to this day. Like, as I talk to you, having to fight, like, out of all the people that Mars knows, you know what I'm saying? Like, what? Like, why is he talking to Derek Sire? Like, this battle of, do I have something to say? And is it interesting or important enough for people to listen? I was listening to Kevin on stage.
Yeah.
He was talking about how people talk themselves out of their passions and their dreams before they even do it.
Yeah.
He was like, so what if there's 1,000 t-shirts? You know, put your t-shirt out. So what if it's 1,000 podcasts? Put your podcast out. Like, so who cares if it's this? You do you. You done talk yourself out of something before you even did it. And here's the thing that, man, and again, I struggle, Mars. I'm telling you, I'm letting you in behind the veil, brother. Like, I struggle with insecurity and worthiness and value. And every time, what has continued to push me forward is the ability to take advantage of opportunities where God shows his grace.
I love it.
Like, you know what I'm saying? As many times as I say, and as much as I hate, you know, the way I'm shaped and the way I look on stage, and, you know, when I think about the number of people that are more educated and qualified than I am, when I get on stage, man, it's like a fish in water.
Yeah.
Like, when I get a mic in my hand, and when I get in this vein, it feels right, man. And one verse that speaks to me as it pertains to that, that nobody can tell me nothing about, is that your gift,
yes, sir,
literally
will
make room. Listen, if you are a one-trick pony, right, if Ice Ice Baby is the only song that you got, when you get on that stage, you better typewriter yourself across. You better MC Hammer dance. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's this concept, no matter how invaluable and insecure and small and insignificant that I feel, when I get in that space, it just feels right. I'm grateful for his grace. I'm grateful for opportunities. I'm grateful for what comes easy to me and what feels hard for others. Like, that's the stuff that I try not to take for granted, man. And I think that's kind of where I'm at.
One thing that I would love for you to talk a little bit about is the value of a one-on-one conversation. I got to know you. First off, I wanted to know you and Hetty. You and Hetty were people that I wanted
Hetty's
to emulate.
Dude, man.
Yeah,
oh,
man.
I love that guy.
Just what you guys did with We Tell Stories, just, you know, seeing you guys on stage and just, but also seeing you having personal one-on-one interactions with people spoke volumes to me. It wasn't just you were charismatic or knew how to say, but seeing you actively listening, seeing you being so pro-community with everything that you do, I want you to talk about the power of a one-on-one conversation.
Yes. You know, this is something that I've had to learn. It's still learning. I haven't mastered it at all. But the power of a one-on-one interaction where you do not have to share your attention. You don't have to divide your intentionality. I was watching Michelle Obama's Becoming Netflix special. And she said she loved touring. She loved being on the road promoting this book, because she got a chance to zero in on people when they came across to shake her hand and she signed her book. Being on stage, you are speaking to thousands. She was in a stadium that had a little bit over 15,000. They were approaching 16. They were at 90% capacity of the facility. And she's saying, being in that environment, you know, you're generally sharing information. But she said what she valued the most was being able to shake people's hands, look them in the eye, and let them be the focus. Think of how many times you have someone's one-on-one attention. You grow up in a class and you're sharing attention. You grow up in a choir and you're sharing attention. You have a job with a manager who manages a group of people. You know, we go throughout life learning to share people and share the attention, to share the focus. In fact, it's one of the things that we learn when we're in kindergarten, right? That's the very first thing. You learn how to share. Learn how to share. But when you can sit down with somebody and you can zero in on them and all your energy and all your vibes and all your focus and all your wisdom and all your suggestions and everything that you have is going towards that person, right? They become the subject of your gifts. They become the subject of your affection, of your focus. And I don't know if you've ever had somebody just pour into you, like pray into you, encourage you. That, my friend, is better than money in a pocket. When you get that, you can literally feel your cup being filled. You can feel life being poured back into you. And I think that's the value of a one-on-one conversation. Now, I will say the reason that I'm learning how to do this, and I haven't mastered it yet, is because if I am in a group setting and I'm trying to one-on-one someone, the FOMO in me, right, the spirit of missing out.
Yeah.
I want to talk to everybody. And so I'm talking to one person, but somebody may come in and I like direct my attention that way and then I come back. And then I have gotten this pin in my mind, like this little thumbtack that says, oop, Mars is in the room. He just came in. I got to make sure I talk to him. Oop, Hades in the room. I just saw him. I got to make sure I hug him. Oop, Tiki's in the room. That's my wife. I got to make sure I go. All while I'm talking to this one person. So to me, the value and the skill that comes with being able to block out the world, block out all the other stuff, and zero in on someone, it's irreplaceable, man. That's second to none. And I think everybody should learn how to do that skill.
That's good stuff. I totally feel what you're saying because I think I've done a terrible job with that. Like, I will be zeroed in on somebody, and then someone will come in, and I'll just act on a, hey, oh my goodness, yes. It's good to have you. Yes. And then they're awkwardly standing there while I'm addressing somebody for 2 minutes. And in some cases, I'll turn around and they're gone. And I'm like, yep, I did that.
Another thing that it's taught me is that when someone does it to me, that I've learned to not take it personal.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I understand that there's so many things going on, and I don't know when the last time you've seen that person. I don't know when you're going to see them again. I don't know what the situation is. So if I'm sitting with someone and somebody walks in and they're like, oh my gosh, hey man, hold on, I'll be right back. Oh, no, that's cool. Go ahead and do that. And I give you options. If I do have time, I'll say, hey, go ahead and do that. I'll pull my phone out, catch up on my text messages, catch up on some emails, scan social media. When you come back, I'll plug right in. Or if I'm on a limited time, I'll say, hey man, you know what? It was about time to wrap up anyway. Go ahead and do that. I'll catch up with you later. That's the grace because I know what that feels like to want to have just everybody. Then I try to extend that grace.
In your journey of becoming who you are now, what do you feel was your lowest point? And how would you encourage others who may be at a similar point to move forward and get out?
Still becoming, you know, still a work in progress. I think when you disappoint the people who believe in you the most, I think that has been a low point for me. I think it's when you have an idea or a concept of what you want to do, what you want to become, who you want to be, and you either fail by not attempting or you fail by intentional self-sabotage or whatever it is. You know what I'm saying? It's like it's the feeling of I want to lose weight, but I keep eating like crap and I won't exercise.
Yeah.
Right? It's the feeling of I want to be a songwriter. I believe God has called me to write and sing and produce music, and I scroll social media for 3 hours, and I know that's time I could be using, you know, perfecting or refining my gift. It's the concept of I know my bills are due, but I'm going to use this money to do whatever. And it's not that people don't understand the error of it, which makes the disappointment that much greater. And so for me, I think there are people who believe in me. I think there are people that have doubts for me. I think there are people that have stuck their name and their neck out for me. And I think there have been some times where I have disappointed them. There have been some times where I've made some very, very stupid decisions. And to see the look on their faces, you know, and keep in mind, the look on the faces is not one that is not filled with grace. It's not one that's not filled with mercy. I believe that I have been very blessed. I've been fortunate to have very patient and understanding and kind people surround me in my life. But when you mess up, you mess up. And I think some low points in my life, in this journey of becoming whoever I am today, right now, tomorrow, I think that's the low point, is to look in those people's faces and see the disappointment. So I don't know. I just imagine, like, the feeling Peter felt when he caught back up with Jesus. Man, you know what, Mars, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm trying not to cry on this interview. But can you imagine somebody that you said you was going to ride for? I ain't gonna never leave you. I ain't going to never forsake. You know what I'm saying? Like, Jesus been walking around, sticking his neck out for you. You know, he done pulled you in. You probably first, second, third, you know, closest person to him. You know what I'm saying? He making sure you eating. He making sure you got somewhere to sleep. He keeping you out of jail and prison. You know what I'm saying? Like, you got somebody that's really sticking his neck out for you. And then when it comes down to, and they be like, hey, ain't you friends with him? You say no. And then can you imagine catching back up with Jesus? Can you imagine how Peter felt? Can you imagine how Judas, this is just me just imagining how Judas felt, you know, after he tried to return the money, after he, on the way to hang himself. Like, can you imagine the disappointment, the anguish? Like, that's real, man. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine, like, being at an altar and asking for forgiveness again for the same thing? Can you imagine that? Like, it's just, and I know there's, you know, there's now, therefore, no more condemnation for those that, you know, like, I understand all that stuff, but we're human. And not only do we want to please men, but we want to please God. And when we're not unable to do that consistently against our better judgment, I don't know that there's a worse pain. I don't know there's a worse ailment. I don't know if there's anything worse than, you know, having to come home and look at your kids in the face, knowing they're hungry and you don't have food. I don't know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's what make them do these extreme things, is because they don't want to feel the pain. They don't want the disappointment. They don't want those things. I don't know, man. So that's what I would say. As I wipe the tears from my face, disappoint my friends and my family, I think that's something that's been the lowest point in my life. And I can trace that back to high school, middle school, college, marriage. I can trace moments of just disappointment. Mm.
I don't understand it to the way that you've lived.
Mm-hmm.
I think how I deal with a lot of disappointment is it hurts so bad, so it turns into repression and masking.
Yeah.
And so sometimes, even when you repress something, it'll just come out. And so sometimes I'll have a flashback of me, even in this conversation, I've had a flashback of me doing something really stupid or really embarrassing or letting somebody down. It's like a gunshot.
Uh-huh.
It just comes out of nowhere and it shoots you and it spreads and there's a recoil and it's like, okay, I have to feel this because this is here. I feel like crap, but let me push this back down. Let me feel this as quickly as humanly possible, and let me press this back down, which isn't healthy, especially if you haven't dealt with the root of it. I feel that. My question to you is, how do you move forward? How do you deal with it? How do you forgive yourself? And how do you move forward?
Yeah, man, I think I'm still learning how to do that. Mm. I think I've learned I've learned more how to move forward than the self-forgiveness.
Wow.
Yeah, which they have to go hand in hand, man. Otherwise, you walk forward into error, and you walk forward into, you know, all these things that you're trying to leave behind. And so that's a great question. I think if you don't deal with forgiveness, and if you don't deal with your struggles, and if you don't deal with those things, then I told somebody the other day, I said, in every situation, in every failure, there's been a common denominator, and it's been me. Mm. Right? And so if you don't deal with it, you move forward and you find yourself in the same situation again and again, over and over again, because you haven't dealt with it. And when you don't operate in forgiveness, when you don't accept it, right? Because it's already there. Right. This is part of our theology. This is part of our faith that God did it one time for all. That it's there. It's a gift. You can't earn it. You just have to receive it. But we want to earn it. We want to be good enough. We want to talk well enough. We want to be able to give enough. We want to be able to serve enough. And I specifically remember there being a verse that says, "Did we not heal in your name? Did we not cry out?"
Wow.
Depart from me.
Yeah.
And so you think about those things, and it's like when you know better, the next thing is to do better. So your question is talking about how do you move forward, and then how do you operate in forgiveness? I think people who move forward without forgiveness, they repress. They make themselves busier and busier and busier to mask the fact that they still got stuff they haven't dealt with. And if I can be on a stage, and if I can be in front of people and make you feel like I'm a good guy, then that masks at least half the problem.
Wow.
Right? Because I would much rather have you think I'm okay and I know the real story than for both of us to know the real story.
Yeah. No, that's real.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But when you're able to operate in forgiveness, and again, this is something that I'm learning to this day. Oh my gosh, to this day. I'm still learning that when you move forward and you operate in a forgiven state, when you do that, then that gives you the strength to move forward in confidence. Moving forward without forgiveness allows you to move forward, but you still move forward in insecurity. You still move forward with doubt because you haven't dealt with it. But moving forward in forgiveness, it gives you the confidence that nobody else can give you. Hey, can't nobody compliment me into forgiveness? Can nobody pay me into forgiveness? You know what I'm saying? That's something that I have to accept. Even though I struggle with unworthiness and I struggle with doubt and self-sabotage, and I don't understand why these things happen, I understand, man, that I have to move forward in a certain way in order to move healthy. And it feels like a contradiction, right? It feels like I tell you on one hand, man, when I'm on that stage, it feels like water, like a fish in water. And I know God put me there because the gifts he's given me, they make room for me. And then on the other side, it's like, but I feel so unworthy and I deal with unforgiveness. But that's the dichotomy. That's the conflict.
Absolutely, yeah.
And man, and it's real. And I wish people would talk about it. I wish people would provide the space for people to say, I am gifted and I am flawed. I'm happy and I'm sad within a matter of minutes. And I think it's not diagnosable as bipolar. You know
right.
what I'm saying? I think that there's some people that have a medical issue. They have a chemical imbalance. But I think for the normal human being, there are people that have these great gifts and these great talents. I got a friend right now who can sing the paint off the wall and can't do simple math.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's a thing.
Paint off the wall, classically trained, cannot do math, simple math. Oh my gosh. Couldn't solve a word problem. You put a gun to her head and was like, I'm gonna shoot you. If there was a train coming from Chicago at 65 miles per hour, and there's one coming from Tulsa at 75 miles per hour, where they gonna meet? It's like,
Them problems be hard though. I hate those math problems. I can find X, I can find Y. But like this whole
But here's the thing. You know, I think that because we see people and we think because they're great in one area, they're great in all areas.
Absolutely.
Right? Derek, he's funny, charismatic, he lights a room up. big smile, they automatically think he has to be a good father. He has to be a good husband. He has to be a man of God. Man, that dude's faith and confidence must be off the chart. And I told somebody this the other day. I said, man, some of my lowest moments is right after I do something really, really great.
Yeah.
Because now I got to fight the enemy off who's telling me I'm a fraud, who's telling me that the only reason I got this opportunity is because whatever. It's you literally fighting off those insecurities. And the only thing that can do it is for you to know that you are forgiven, for you to know that you are a child of God, to know that you are protected, to know that you have the strength, right, that is found only in the joy and forgiveness of Jesus. I mean, it's just, I don't know, man. I just wish people would be a little more transparent and say, hey, listen, I love God and I love Cheetos, right?
You know, no, but that's real. Yeah,
I believe in the Bible, and I'm overweight. Like, I wish people would just say, "Hey, man, I got a drinking problem. I love God, but I just wish there's a platform and a safe space. People don't feel safe, man, and so they mask it and they front and they hide it. It's easy to do, especially if you know all the churchisms and the mannerisms."
It's easy to do if you're gifted. It's easy to do if you're charismatic. It's easy to do if you're attractive.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Ooh. I heard a friend say he was joking. He said all the ugly people at the altar.
Ooh. I can't. I know. I'm about to pass out. I can't do it.
Yeah. She said all the beautiful, gifted, and sinless people on stage.
Yikes. I gotta go.
All the ugly people, all the untalented, got nothing to cover up. Those are the ones at the altar getting all the forgiveness, getting all the grace. All the beautiful, unbroken, sinless people are the ones on stage. Now, that's some sarcasm there. That's some cynicism there, of course. But I get what you're saying. I get it. As somebody who's been at the altar and on stage, I get exactly what he's saying.
Oh, dude, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Listen. Well, on that note,
concludes episode one.
Bro, well, that was the benediction. I sincerely hope that our conversation encouraged, inspired, or challenged you. Until next time, I love you all and take care.